Kathy. I'm sitting at the bar at Simon's Tavern in Andersonville drinking some glug, and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Yep, it is glug season. Get on over to Simon's in Andersonville, the best glug in Chicago. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It is wonderful to be here with you today for show number 948. What we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty today in the WGN radio studio, as always. So, hello to Bob. And again, it's great to be here on the show today. We get an update on a local bookstore that's unfortunately calling it quits. Also, we examine the state of local food journalism and the map of Chicago. Well, it could get an update. There's a plan for that, and we talk to one of the folks behind that plan. Okay, so there is a lot of talk about the finances of Chicago recently. Budget shortfalls, you know the drill. This past Sunday, the Tribune ran an editorial called Downtown Chicago Needs Reimagining. In the editorial, they recount how the editorial board welcomed a collection of esteemed, civic-minded folks to their office. People like the CEO of Broadway in Chicago, the VP of the Obama Foundation, the executive director of the Joffrey Ballet, heck, even Rick Bayless. They were all there. And they were there visiting with the editorial board with, quote, not so much a grand scheme to rival what Burnham came up with in 1909, but an array of small, scalable, potentially executable plans designed to breathe more life into Chicago's struggling downtown core, end quote. Okay, I'm on board. Let's revitalize downtown. Let's get some money flowing through the place. What ideas are out there? Well, the editorial goes on to say, quote, what about a floating farmer's market on the Chicago River? Or a barge filled with food trucks that would dock at different spots? Or barges filled with actors, musicians, and dancers plying the waterways? End quote. Sounds like a cool idea. I think it's, wait a minute. Were these hot shots listening to Outside the Loop recently? Maybe on November 16th on Outside the Loop number 944, when I was talking about the budget crunch at the beginning of the show, I thought the city could charge admission for hot tubs on the Chicago River. Do we have the tape of that? We do have the tape. Let's roll the tape. Couldn't the city come up with a fleet of these floating hot tubs and charge like $500 a pop? People would absolutely take advantage of that. The city could have the beef barge on the river. It's a barge or a boat, but a barge might have more character. And the barge has mini kitchens set up where some of the best local Italian beef joints could cook up hot sandwiches for folks. And people could enjoy those sandwiches on the barge with a beautiful view of the city behind them. It's another opportunity for revenue. I'd check out the beef barge if this was a thing. Or a pizza barge, or a sushi barge, Thai food boat, a taco water transport. We're sitting on a gold mine here. A gold mine indeed. Look, I'm very humble here. I won't take credit for the barge idea. All right, maybe I'll take a little credit. I didn't make the invite for the Trib editorial board, but maybe next time, Chicago Tribune. The Italian beef barge idea is a winner, I say. Back in April, on this very show, we looked at the map of Chicago in more detail, specifically the community area map, or a neighborhood map, as it's sometimes called. A study out of the University of Chicago looks to give that map an update when it comes to neighborhood boundaries. Emily Tallon is a professor of urbanism and the director of the Urbanism Lab at the University of Chicago. And in April, she told us that there was some data being analyzed and, Well, we have an update on the data and the map. Emily is here with us once again on Outside the Loop. Emily, nice to talk to you again.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me.
You got it. So, okay, remind us of the origins of the map. And when I say the community area map, it's the map that I think we all are accustomed to with Chicago. Maybe some of us bought a copy of it and we display it in our homes. This actually comes out of the 1920s, though, right? I mean, areas were mapped, but people were mapped too, weren't they?
Yeah. I mean, this is more than 100 years old that people at the University of Chicago, some sociologists, came up with the community areas. And so, you know, a lot has changed in the last 100 years. So it's curious that we still are bound by those. They still have meaning for a lot of people, and actually our survey showed that. But our motivation was to kind of update that. They were never meant to be neighborhoods. They were meant to be much larger kind of research based kind of entities where people could collect data and track population change and things like that. Not necessarily neighborhood where people have a common identity and there's some, you know, sense of collective purpose, things like that.
That's interesting. I think how the map has evolved into what you just said. And certainly we can say some names of neighborhoods in Chicago, and I think maybe we conjure up images and, you know, who's there. So really, you know, you talk about sociology here. This is an interesting sort of sociological thing that we have sort of congregated in these areas. And I know that there's a lot of history as to why that has happened. But then we sort of identify, you know, ourselves as members of these neighborhoods. And I think that, you know, Chicago being sort of this ethnic enclave situation that it is, I mean, it's almost like, do we think that that was inevitable? Like that was always going to happen?
I guess, yeah, it's kind of tragic in a way, because if neighborhoods are defined by homogeneity and, you know, everybody in the neighborhood is the same, mm-hmm. Which was the motivation 100 years ago for defining these community areas, look for the most commonality in terms of demographics and ethnicity, that's not necessarily a good thing. I mean, we want people to have identity, and certainly people like to be around people that are like themselves, but really putting boundaries on it and, you know, putting an imprint of a map that's all about this sort of social segregation view of Chicago is not necessarily the best way to go about things.
So this map that we're talking about here, I mean, there are 77 community areas in Chicago, and that's pretty well known. So what you did is you sent out some surveys to, well, people all over the place in Chicago, really. And you were just asking them to kind of reflect on the areas where they live, the boundaries maybe that they saw in their perceived neighborhoods. Tell us about the survey that you got out there.
Yeah, so we had a survey, and by the way, it's still live, chicago-neighborhoods.com. And so our approach was a crowdsourced kind of approach rather than, you know, a scientific survey that would ask every 100 people in the city what their neighborhood was. So a crowdsourced approach is kind of different, but we had an app. We did all kinds of marketing. We hired, TikTok influencers and tried to get the word out.
Yeah.
Initially we had very poor representation on the South Side. And so we went through a whole effort hiring people, students to go out and knock on doors and distribute flyers and go to community meetings and really tried to up the representation. So we did try our best, but we were pretty happy with, in the end, about 5,500 responses that were usable. We had, went through a process of, okay, you have these 5,500 boundaries that people have delineated. What are you going to do now to kind of put it all together and come up with some consensus? And the map that was just published in Block Club Chicago is one approach to trying to do that.
So tell us about the map. I mean, I know this is an audio medium, so we can't see the map necessarily, but in terms of the data that you collected, what you heard from the people, and then how you translate that to a map, tell us about what has changed or what has shifted from this original map that maybe a lot of us are familiar with.
Yeah, well, you do need to go in and explore the interactive map where you can kind of zoom in and out. I guess the interesting thing to me was how in some areas, it seems like the community areas do really hold, you know, like that's how people are thinking of their neighborhood, maybe from 100 years of it being called that. And for example, Lincoln Park was pretty well in sync with the community area and is very large, that area. Mm-hmm. Bridgeport is another one that synced pretty well. But then there's other places where they're not syncing. And I've been having some people have been contacting me through the Urbanism Lab and telling me about, you know, one person said, where did my neighborhood go? This is not what my neighborhood is.
Yeah.
And so that's interesting. So, but what, you know, there were 550 different names of neighborhoods that were submitted. So,
wow.
What we did, I mean, we took this, we call it the winner takes all approach to assigning names to aggregated polygon areas. And I don't want to get too boring with technical details, but it's an interesting geographic conundrum to try to, you know, figure out how to create a consensus map, you know, where this is where most people said this particular thing was. Ravenswood is one that is not a community area, and it straddles four different community areas. So there was some agreement about that. North Center was divided almost in half between one group calling it North Center and one group calling it Roscoe Village. Lakeview had some encroachment by Uptown.
Sure. Yeah.
And so, yeah. And then there was definitely an agreement on an area called Lakeview East, which, again, is not a community area. Let's see. I mean, North Lawndale, just to take some west side, there was agreement on half of it. So, like the whole western half of North Lawndale was identified as a neighborhood in a consensus kind of way, with a lot of people agreeing on that name. A whole chunk of it around Douglas Park was just left out. Not, you know, nobody was kind of identifying it as part of their neighborhood. Englewood, same. Some of these community areas on the south side also had the situation where people were calling it Englewood for like a fraction of what the community area is. So that just gets back to my original point that these community areas are awfully large to be thought of as neighborhoods for a lot of people.
Yeah.
So that's kind of one takeaway there.
So that's interesting because, you know, what you're doing here and why you're doing this work and thinking about Chicago in this way is really the importance of community. And as it stands now, like you just said, these community areas, they're pretty big and they represent, I think it was about 35,000 people in some of these areas. But you said that it should be, if we're talking about neighborhoods, it should be more like 5,000. So this is really about the importance of togetherness, of community, of people identifying that, hey, we all have this in common because here we are. But maybe that it should be smaller is what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a lot harder to have that sense of collective purpose, commonality, if you're talking about a giant area that's really the size of a small city. Because neighborhood is supposed to be something where, you know, there's all kinds of theories, but some people say you should be able to know a lot of people in your neighborhood, you know, and if it's giant like that, you're not going to. But also, what is the level at which you can effectuate change? You know, can you really, you know, have a political voice? If it's a huge area and there's so many competing voices, that have, you know, that are interested in all different parts of that community area, not a consolidated part that where everybody has kind of a common identity. It's just harder to get people to rally around the importance of a park that's in one part of the community area and you live nowhere near that, you know. So the more localized, I think it's better for sense of neighborhood, coming together, having change, you know, having governance of some sort, knowing your neighbor's sense of community, just like you said.
Yeah. And I think in that, and you touched on it, political power for sure to mm-hmm, be able to affect mm-hmm. that change. And I know with this map, I think it's going from the 77 community areas on the previous map, the old map, I guess. And now is it about 120 areas? Is that right?
Yep. Yep.
Okay. So 120 areas. And then it goes back to your point about keeping it smaller.
Yeah. Yeah. These are smaller. But again, I was surprised at how large they were, despite all these things I just said about the importance of local, you know, connection and sense of community. And that to me just speaks to the imprint of the community areas. If you have been pressing upon people, community area for the last 100 years, and every map they see of Chicago neighborhoods are the community areas, you know, that tends to lodge into people's brains. So I guess it's interesting in the areas where that has not stuck. And maybe that's an indication of strength of neighborhood feeling in those particular areas.
I know the survey is still up, chicago-neighborhoods.com. But hey, city council, I don't know, might have some independence, it looks like, from the mayor. Who knows what's going on? Are you going to float this to the alder people and say, hey, we've got some serious gerrymandering going on in the city. Maybe take a look at this map.
So crazy. It's so crazy. Yeah. I mean, they have no official neighborhoods at all. Even the community areas aren't really official. And maybe that's it, if they would do something like that, kind of make these boundaries a little more meaningful, then it would be harder to do the gerrymandering. And, you know, so I don't know. There's likely a resistance to that kind of effort. Which is, I have to say, a disappointment, because other cities are not like that. Other cities do take their neighborhood, you know, how people understand their neighborhoods and their neighborhood identity in a localized way. They take it more seriously and they pay attention to it. And so we would like Chicago to do so, but we'll just keep hammering. The survey is still up. We'll keep having people weigh in. And, you know, maybe eventually some conversations will happen.
Well, you are sparking those conversations with your research at the Urbanism Lab at the University of Chicago. And we can all check out chicago-neighborhoods.com if we would like to partake in the survey. And I think this is important when we think about the map of Chicago and representation and community and togetherness and how we can affect change. Emily Tallon is a professor of urbanism and again, the director of the Urbanism Lab at the University of Chicago. Emily, I always appreciate the time. Congrats on all of your hard work. I know it's still going, so keep it going, and we'll talk soon.
All right. Well, thanks so much for letting me talk about this.
Always love to talk about local food, and so does Mike Gebert. He is the editor at Fooditor. We could check out fooditor.com. That's F-O-O-D-I-T-O-R, fooditor.com. It's kind of like editor, except food. Yay. I thought we would check in with Mike because he is always knowing what's going on in the food scene, and there's always so much happening with local food. Mike, great to talk to you again, man.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
You are very welcome. So, yes, you cover the local food scene, and recently you wrote about what's happening over at Eater Chicago, which, of course, I think a lot of us know has been a very popular local food website to get all the ins and outs of what's going on locally here in the food scene. But there's some stuff going on with Eater. Can you just bring us up to speed about what you know?
Well, so Vox, which is the media company that owns Eater and several other sites, announced that they would be they're letting some people go. They consolidated some of the sites. I think a site called Pop Sugar was brought under Eater. And we really don't know what's going on in Chicago. They're, you know, as usual with media companies, they didn't tell us anything.
Yeah.
You know, I always found that, you know, if you were trying to report on places that report on other people and expect them to give them straight answers or take tough questions, they will avoid answering anything they can. So we really don't know. But I've been kind of watching the end of last week and this week to see, you know, are they still hiring as many freelancers as they were? You know, how many stories are they publishing? And I would say so far it looks like it's still going at the same speed, but you just don't know. You know, maybe those are all things that they were already committed to. And it just kind of prompted me to think about how, you know, how like media things, online media things now, I mean, they're not built to last. As I pointed out in my newsletter this week, I mean, the Tribune and the Sun-Times both date to the 1840s, you know, which they might as well date to ancient Greece at that point.
Yeah.
And you know, so, and even something relatively recent like The Reader is 50 years old. And there just isn't that kind of longevity in the online space. You know, places last about 10 years, if lucky, and then they sell to somebody and that's the end of them. So we just don't know what's going to happen.
And I guess that leads into a bigger question about the state of local food journalism. You mentioned the Trib and the Sun-Times, and I know that they have food and dining sections, especially online. I know the print has atrophied quite a bit here, but in terms of what you're seeing just across Chicago, there's so much going on here. I know you are a part of it, too. There's a lot to talk about it. And it's not just openings and closings, but there are stories about chefs and food itself and recipes. So, I mean, are we doing okay? Are we healthy here when it comes to local food journalism?
No, I feel like a lot of the places have kind of backed off of it. I find the Tribune's coverage really weak at the moment. They've obviously decided that a lot of their audience is out in the suburbs because suddenly, boy, they're covering the hell out of being on, you know, being in Naperville or something like that.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of McDonald's stories at the, you know, in the relatively recent coverage of the Tribune. Sun-Times is fairly out of the food game, although they'll occasionally do a story just as a news story. You know, then there's other things. I mean, the Reader's thinner on it. Things like Time Out have sort of backed out of it. They run a review like maybe every third week, it seems like.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think there's a, you know, whatever's going on in the food scene, you'd have a hard time finding it if you don't know people. I mean, if there's a new restaurant, I ask people I know who eat out a lot more than I'm likely to go looking for coverage of it. But, you know, I mean, it's kind of, it reminds me of like the coverage at Red Eye or somewhere a few years ago. It's, you know, the assumption is that the audience is, you know, 24 years old and wants to go party every night, basically.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, and one of the things that I talked about in my newsletter is just, you know, it'd be a really good time to support all these people doing Substack newsletters, because that's where you're getting, you know, honest, in-depth coverage. I should mention Chicago Magazine, I think, is fairly strong at the moment. So, you know, there's reviewing and a fair amount of coverage there. But still, there's, you know, what we had even just a few years ago kind of doesn't exist right now. And I strongly urge people to support some of these independent newsletters. I can't imagine that people are making real money at them, but if they make some money at them and are able to keep it going as a hobby with a little revenue coming in, then, you know, good for them. So,
yeah, I mean, it's a tough time, I think, for journalism across the board. I've talked about it here.
Sure.
And we're seeing, you know, the arts and what we're talking about here with food. I mean, I think you see that that might go first, you know?
Right. No, I know. I think about that sometimes. It's like, if I wanted to find a play to go to, I don't even know where to look at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, what is the publication that talks about that? I guess I know a couple of websites, but I don't know who else does. Who covers theater anymore? Who covers, you know, museum openings? That was the kind of stuff that was part of what the Tribune was proud of, and I just don't know that it exists anymore.
Yeah. I mean, we'll have to see where this goes, but I mean, I kind of feel the same way you do when it comes to issues around food, but also the arts, like we were talking about. Where do you go? It's becoming more and more difficult these days to find credible journalism that has information that is valuable to us. You know, all right, let's look at some happy information here, some happy thoughts, I guess you could say. Earlier this week, hey, Michelin Awards were announced. Chicago on the list still. And overall, we're doing okay, right, when it comes to that? We've got a bunch of restaurants there.
Just okay, I'd say. I don't know that I think this is a happy story either. Sorry to be Debbie Downer here. But, you know, I mean, the good news is that Carino, which is a wonderful Mexican restaurant from Norman Fenton, who used to be the chef at Schwa, and is doing really interesting, playful things with Mexican flavors. He's also involved with a restaurant in Tulum, and he travels back and forth. So he's very much in contact with Mexican food culture. So he got a star, and that's great. The trouble is, if you look at the list overall, we lost a bunch of the Bib Gourmands. We lost, you know, one of the only 2 stars went down to 1 star. One of the relatively few 1 stars went to none, which was Omakase Yume. The places that everybody talks about as being so swell and they ought to get something from Michelin one of these days, you know, from Kyoten, the high-end sushi restaurant, to Valhalla, which is an upscale restaurant. It used to be in Time Out Market, but it's now where, speaking of sushi, Mirai used to be, I think.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Anyway, these are the places that people kind of expected to get some Michelin attention. And I always feel, think about what Michelin might do, then pick as little of it as seems at all plausible, and you'll probably be right. So one new star is about it.
Wow. So that's not good is what you're saying. It could be better.
Michelin, I don't know. I feel like they don't understand Chicago, and maybe they don't like Chicago. You know, it's one of those things when in Singapore, they give awards to, you know, hawker stalls on the street. You know, they don't expect everything to be a fancy Parisian restaurant. But here in Chicago, you know, there are great restaurants that they just never paid any attention to, like the Bristol, say. And to me, that was such a quintessential Chicago restaurant. It's hard not to think that they just don't like whatever it is we like when you see them completely ignore something like that. So Michelin, down with them.
Yeah, down with Michelin.
Ah. Yeah.
Hey, Eddie, before I let you go, Mike, anything that you're into in terms of food, any places, any kinds of food locally here that's kind of getting you excited? Maybe we'll end on a happy note here.
Yeah. I really like Bracero, which is John Mannion's new restaurant. John Mannion has El Shea Bar and Steakhouse, or whatever its official name is. You know, he grew up in South America. His dad was in, you know, corporate business from the U.S. and South America. So he does, you know, interesting things in kind of a South American style, big fire burning behind the counter and stuff like that. So I really like that. That's in, I don't know, what is that? Bucktown, Ukrainian Village?
Yeah,
somewhere.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Somewhere in there. And then what else have I liked? Oh, and Dear Margaret, which I continue to really like. It's about 2 years old now, but I mean, a really charming kind of French-Canadian restaurant. But very much a neighborhood place, easy to like in that regard. I'm really interested by a place called John's Food and Wine. I don't know if you've talked about that, because they have you know, they're like kind of changing how the model for hiring staff and ordering works. You know, mostly you sit at your table and order off a QR code, which I don't particularly care for. But if you don't like that, you can always sit at the bar and you can actually talk to a human there. But I think they do kind of cool food, and they're, you know, they're reacting realistically to the changes in the job market and the price of dining out and stuff like that, by trying to create a new model that makes it affordable for them and profitable for them. So,
well, hey, those sound like good places. Some recommendations from Mike Gebert. And yeah, we are ending on a happy note. I like that. There's lots of good stuff out there in Chicago. We're trying to get the word out there about it when it comes to local food. And there's so much to discuss. And we can all check out the website, fooditor.com, F-O-O-D-I-T-O-R, fooditor.com. Mike Gebert is the editor of that website. Go ahead and subscribe to his newsletter as well. Lots of great local info about the local food scene. Hey, Mike, I always appreciate the time. Thanks, and we'll do it again.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
This week, it was announced that the owner of Quimby's Bookstore is selling the business, located at 1854 West North Avenue in Chicago, after more than 30 years of operation. And this store is just great. It has all kinds of books, publications, and zines that you can't find anywhere else. Liz Mason is the store manager of Quimby's, and she said that she's also moving on from the store. Back in September of 2021, Liz came on Outside the Loop to talk about the store and its impact on Chicago. That was around the store's 30th anniversary. So let's rewind and check out part of that conversation right now.
Our mission has always been to carry small press periodicals, independently published zines, and other type of aberrant reading material.
I love the mission. I mean, there are all kinds of things you can find inside of Quimby's. And you mentioned zines, and I think that's worth calling out because maybe some of us listening, we might not know what a zine is. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, so the short answer is it's an independently published periodical. That can mean a lot of different things, but the typical characteristics of a zine are little to no advertising or not a lot of advertising. Mm-hmm. A small distribution radius, which really just means a small readership. Maybe they only print at most a couple hundred copies. Isn't typically very glossy, is often stapled, and is usually covering topics that are a little bit more idiosyncratic and typically not found in the mainstream.
And I think it's great because, I mean, Quimby's, like we're talking about here, is definitely an outlet for zines, these self-published magazines. It's possible to get your message and your work out there, and you don't have to go through sort of the big time publishers. And there's definitely a community for that.
Definitely. A lot of the people who publish zines are people doing it with their own resources by themselves, or maybe with, you know, a few friends, and we're happy to sell it for them. All they have to do is bring it in or send it to us and fill out our consignment form, and they designate the retail price. And then once something sells, they get 60% of their retail price, and we'll take it almost no questions asked, as long as it, you know, retails under a certain price and some other logistical considerations. We're happy to do a little bit of paperwork and put it out on our floor to sell and to help get the word out about the thing that they're creating.
I think that's so cool because this consignment model allows local authors and artists and creatives to come to you and say, hey, I've got some stuff I'd love to put out there. And then you're able to do that. So you're able to showcase a lot of, you know, local talent that, let's be honest, sometimes it's difficult when you're doing something like this. If you're publishing, it's difficult to get your message, your work out there. So I know a lot of artists and writers just love to go to Quimby's because it's a great outlet for their work.
Yeah, it's true. We definitely, because we have the consignment model, we don't have to pay for stuff up front. We wait until after it's sold. So it allows us to not have to do the hard sell. Like, basically, you know, we just have a little bit of labor on the front end of it and are able to put that stuff out there without feeling like, oh, we've already bought this stuff wholesale. We got to like do the used car salesperson thing of, you know, jamming it down someone's throat. You know, like, it's really nice to be able to just be like, you know what? I haven't read this. Could be awesome. Could be not awesome. I don't know. But happy to put it out there for other people to come in and take a look at it.
When we talk about the state of alternative media, how are things looking when we survey that alternative media landscape in Chicago?
Well, it always feels prolifically represented to me because I live in a little independent publishing bubble where literally it comes addressed to the store address where I work. And so I see the stack of mail come in every day. You know, like every day stuff comes in from all over. It's like Christmas. We have our consignment form on our website. So, you know, you could print it out and send us your zines. It's totally unsolicited. We don't know that it's coming. And so we're checking it in every day. And so people who say like zines faded out, now they're having a resurgence. Like in my mind, it's like, don't call it a comeback. Like, you know, like literally zines have been here for years. And just because one person has kind of faded away from paying attention to it doesn't mean that it wasn't still there. It definitely feels like every day people are locally even are dropping stuff off. And we never feel like we're totally caught up in putting all the stuff in the computer that we need to put in because we get so much stuff.
On that rewind clip, that was Liz Mason, store manager at Quimby's Books in the Wicker Park neighborhood from Outside the Loop number 778 from September of 2021. It was announced earlier this week that the owner plans to sell Quimby's, so get on over there while you can, 1854 West North Avenue. The owner did say that supporting indie media is the number one priority, so that's good. But it's the end of an era. Maybe, though, someone else will carry the store into a new era. And that'll do it. Outside the Loop show number 948 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. Thanks, as always, to Bob Ferguson for all of his engineering skills in the WGN radio studio. And thank you again for listening to the show. Have a wonderful week. I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.